Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's key and critical arguments before the Supreme Court, which go to the heart of the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. Dahlia Lithwick, a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, who covers the Supreme Court, joins us. She was in the Supreme Court today, and we will discuss what many court watchers are describing as a disastrous day for President Obama and supporters and beneficiaries of his health care reform law. Then we'll look into the Pope's visit to Cuba, where he is now meeting with Raul Castro and may or may not meet with Raul's brother Fidel. Joining us is a former political analyst with the Cuban government, Arturo López Levy, and a professor of Hispanic Studies, Marta Hernandez Salvan. We will discuss the gulf between the Pope's call for an open society in Cuba and a Cuban government's official's statement that there will be no political reform in Cuba. Then finally, we will speak with Brendan Fisher, a law fellow with the Center for Media and Democracy, who have been at the forefront in exposing ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. We will examine the big brand corporate powers behind ALEC, who have had hundreds of model bills passed in state legislatures across the country, including the controversial Stand Your Ground law in Florida. Joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And you're in the court today, and I must say, court watchers the sky is falling. Disaster, wipeout, the president's Affordable Care Act in danger, in dire jeopardy. What were you left with today?
I'm not sure I was quite that disheartened. It was not, by any stretch, a good day for the Affordable Care Act. I think that it was very, very clear early in the argument that this was going to divide on partisan lines. The four liberals on the court seemed overwhelmingly to support it. The four most conservative justices on the court seemed quite opposed to it, surprisingly in some cases. And that left everybody's eyes on Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is, you know, often the swing voter in these cases. And he certainly looked, at least for the first hour of this two-hour argument, as though he had real serious problems with the individual mandate. And that's obviously the heart and soul of this piece of legislation. If the individual mandate goes down, it all comes down. And Kennedy really made noises very early on in the argument that he thought, for instance, just right at the very beginning, he said, quote, assume this law is unprecedented, which is never a thing that you want to hear, and said several times that he thought that the government had sort of created regulation in order to created commerce in order to regulate commerce. Just throughout the first hour looked as though he was very doubtful about the mandate. But I will say that I think in the second hour of oral argument, when the challengers to the ACA stepped forward, he was quite interested in questioning them, and also I think at the very end certainly suggested that he might at least be contemplating the argument that is, again, critical in this case, that regulating the health insurance market is really different from regulating other markets. It's in fact necessary that the government do it. So I guess my takeaway is it was certainly not a good day for Obamacare. I'm not sure it was quite the unmitigated disaster we're hearing, and I think it's really important also to remember that what you see at oral argument is never the whole story.
So in other words, because Paul Clement, arguing for the 26 states against the Affordable Care Act, apparently did well, and the Solicitor General, Donald Varelli, arguing for the Obama administration, apparently didn't do so well, that's not the deciding factor. It's not a popularity contest between who does the best lawyering, I presume. I mean, they're going to spend a few months, right? It's not coming out till June.
Right. And I think, you know, an issue of this magnitude, Ian, I mean, you know, this is the court presumably poised to strike down the president's and Congress's signature health care reform. I don't think you do that on the strengths or weaknesses of the relative argument. That said, I thought the enthusiasm with which they beat up on Don Verrilli, the Solicitor General, certainly suggests that there's an awful lot of votes to strike this down. And, you know, it's worth pointing out that an awful lot of court watchers, across the ideological spectrum, came into this case absolutely sure this thing was going to be upheld by an 8-1 or 7-2 margin.
Well, when initially these lawsuits were lodged, the general consensus was they were frivolous. It's amazing to see how far they've come. And I suppose in the back of your mind, you have to say, well, even though this would be a radical act on the part of the Supreme Court, they recently took a radical act in Citizens United. So they're capable of nasty surprises.
Well, I think that cuts both ways. I think it's certainly true. Anybody who remembers Bush v. Gore knows that the court can hand down a searing 5-4 ideological opinion if the need arises. But I do think that the blowback, both from Bush v. Gore and from Citizens United, makes the court a little bit leery about doing it again. I think that, you know, there's always a tension in the court's view of how far it can really push its own legitimacy and credibility in the public eye. And this case is one of those cases where it seems to me there's going to be a lot of soul searching, at least, I think, you know, clearly, Anthony Kennedy and maybe the Chief Justice, it looks to me, are really grappling not with the sort of constitutional merits, but also the political ramifications of saying we are not an activist court, we are a humble minimalist court, but we are going to strike down this massive, massive piece of legislation.
It seems strange to me that that the defenders have to explain to the justices why allowing the government to compel individuals to buy insurance did not mean that the government could make individuals buy anything, in which case broccoli was offered up as an example. I mean, $1 in $6 in the U.S. economy is spent on health care. I'm surprised that it in fact, Verrilli had to be coached. He had to be coached yesterday by Breyer and again today by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who had to point out that, just quoting what she said, "I thought what was unique about this is it's not my choice whether I want to buy a product to keep me healthy, but the cost that I am forcing on other people if they don't buy the product sooner rather than later." And that gets to the heart of the defense, surely, that this is about a pool. And if everybody joins the pool, then it works. If people don't join the pool, it doesn't work.
Again, in fairness, I don't know that she was coaching Verrilli. I think she was trying to restate the argument he was struggling to make crisply. But I do think it is clear that the opponents of the Affordable Care Act predicated their big, big argument today on two different premises. One is that this is regulating inactivity, that for the first time ever, Congress is forcing people to purchase something that they don't want and they don't need. And the argument that Ginsburg was offering, the argument that Verrilli was offering, the argument on which the entire healthcare bill rests, is that the choice to not purchase health insurance isn't like the choice to not purchase broccoli or not purchase a car, because someday everybody will need health care. And her point was, it's all very well and good to say you're making a choice to do nothing, but you are in fact making a choice to shift the cost for your someday needed health care onto everyone else. And that's this argument that the healthcare market is unique. It's not like choosing not to buy a car. It's not like choosing not to buy broccoli. And moreover, and several of the justices invoke this idea of, you know, the government can't force you to purchase a car. But of course, the government doesn't then provide you with a free car at the end of the day, which is exactly what they do with healthcare. And one of the things that was interesting that arose several times today is that there is a law in this country that says that you cannot turn people away from the emergency room just because they don't have health insurance. And that kind of was flipped by Justices Scalia and by several of the justices to imply that, well, Congress has created this problem by saying you can't turn away any comers to the ER, therefore Congress can't create this as a fix. The implication, I think, being, Ian, that maybe that law is a bad law, this just poleaxed Don Verrilli, the Solicitor General, who said, we have a moral consensus in this country that we don't turn people away when they don't have health care. But I have to say, there were several justices who really do think that's the cause of the problem.
Well, isn't that pretty extraordinary that even that modest introduction of reality or morality into something that is so deeply at the core of our society. I mean, I guess none of the arguments about the need for healthcare are allowed in this kind of abstract argument. I mean, here we have we're living in a country we're the first in spending with some of the worst outcomes. We're the first in obesity. We're the 25th in preventing death from heart disease, 27th in life expectancy, 29th in the number of practicing doctors, 31st in the availability of healthcare coverage, and 31st in infant mortality. I guess that's a separate argument, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, certainly don't think that that argument wasn't made. I think Sonia Sotomayor did try to talk very forcefully about we live in a modern world, we live in a modern economy, there is a need for this. Justice Breyer was as eloquent as I've ever heard him today. Each of the justices on the left side of the court, I think, tried to make the point that you can't just opt out. You can't opt out. This isn't a world in which we all just take care of ourselves and hope for the best. But it was really, it was very, very intriguing to see it come back again and again. Ian, I counted 8 references to broccoli at the argument today, and that was meant to sort of be a talking point or a bumper sticker, but it's kind of turned into doctrine that somehow if the government can force you to purchase health insurance, forcing you to join a gym, says Justice Scalia, forcing you to purchase a cell phone, says Chief Justice John Roberts, or forcing you to buy broccoli, say both Scalia and Roberts, is the next stop. And it seems to be an argument about slippery slopes, but it's not an argument about why there was this urgent, urgent need. You know, Stephen Breyer kept saying millions and millions of people uninsured that the rest of us pay for, all of our premiums jacked up. The only way to fix it was what happened, and yet that seemed just a preposterous argument today.
Well, I'm mystified, though, Dahlia Lithwick, because surely the government has been able to force people. For example, they've conscripted people into the military, which is another way of saying they could force you to die. But they're arguing now against people who are trying to have us live better and longer.
Well, I think there are 2 responses that the opponents of the ACA would make. One is, yes, you can be forced to do jury duty. Yes, you can be forced to register for the draft. Yes, you can be forced to be a census taker. But those are all things that are laid out in the Constitution as obligations intended to your citizenship. And that's quite different, they say again, and this brings us to the second thing, from being forced to buy something. So that's the line that they draw. I think there's some rumble that there was something called the Militia Act in the George Washington era, in which everyone was forced to purchase a gun. And so there's certainly been some mumbling on the other side of the aisle that that would have been the best analogy, that people have been forced to purchase things in this country for a long time. But that wasn't mentioned today. It hasn't gotten a lot of traction. I think the basic point is, and Justice Ginsburg made this argument today, we had this fight over Social Security, we had this fight over the minimum wage, we have had this fight every time a massive, sweeping piece of social legislation has passed, and yet it's always been deemed to be within the boundaries of what interstate commerce can be regulated by Congress. So today we're having this fight, and it actually looks as though the line has been drawn in a place that nobody expected it to be drawn.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Pope's visit to Cuba. Don't nobody but 'cause here come the judge. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marta Hernandez-Salvin and Arturo Lopez Levy. Arturo Lopez Levy is a former political analyst with the Cuban government and is now a lecturer and PhD candidate at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He teaches Latin American politics and comparative politics at the University of Denver and the Colorado School of Mines. And Marta Hernandez-Salvin is a professor of Hispanic studies at the University of California, Riverside, whose current research focuses on the ideological and emotional trauma created after the withering of the socialist utopia in Cuba. Her forthcoming book, Hyperbolic Moment, studies the work of Cuban post-revolutionary poets and essayists. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marta Hernandez-Salvin and Arturo Lopez Levy. Hello.
It's a great pleasure.
Well, let me begin.
Well, good afternoon, Ian.
Good afternoon, Marta. Let me begin with Arturo. There's obviously a gulf between the rhetoric used by the Pope in his first day in Cuba, calling for an open society, and a Cuban government official statement that there will be no political reform in Cuba. But first of all, since you've worked for the Cuban government in the past, what does the Cuban government get out of improving its relationships with the Catholic Church and the Vatican?
Well, I worked for the Cuban government in 1994. It was a long time ago. But as an analyst, what I see is that the visit of the Pope and the special relationship and dialogue between the government and the Catholic Church is building a special channel of communication, a dialogue between the two most important organizations of the island today. In one side is the Communist Party and the government that has close to 800,000 members. And on the other side, you have the most relevant, the organization with the highest number of members in the Cuban civil society. This is very important because the party need somebody to tell them what is happening in civil society. They know firsthand because they have ways to test the waters and to learn about the opinions of the people. But on the other hand, the pluralism that is growing in civil society reach its highest expression in this organization that is national, is very well connected in all the national territory. It's also present in every diaspora community of Cubans in the United States, in Venezuela, in Mexico, in Spain. And also, it's an organization that has been able in the past to reverse the policies of official atheism and develop a network of educational institutions, publications, institution for poverty alleviation that are very important in the Cuban context.
And Marta Hernandez-Salvin, yes. You go to Cuba a lot, and my understanding is that only about 10% of Cubans are practicing Catholics. Something like 80% practice some form or other of an Afro-Cuban religion, including Santeria. But I also understand that there are about some 600,000 Cubans now have been sort of converted to Protestant evangelical religion, and that is a trend throughout Latin America. The growth of charismatic Protestant evangelicals, which I understand has got the Catholic Church concerned. Are they concerned? They're concerned about Cuba as well in that regard.
Well, you know, I think what I have noticed every time that I've gone to Cuba lately is that actually the number of Catholic practitioners has raised considerably because of the fact that the Catholic Church provides with social services that the government unable to provide the citizens with at this point.
such as, books, free food, entertainment, etc. On the other hand, what you're saying is true, right? And I think that have been caused by the lack of hope in the younger generation, which are becoming more and more apolitical. And as everywhere else, the rise of all these other religions happens because there is a lack of ideological content in in the type of socialism that the state is still promoting, and that makes young people to go towards other areas of that can give them something to believe in. So I think that's happening as in other countries.
Well, let me ask Arturo Lopez Levy. Before the Pope arrived in Cuba, he was talking about Cuba, and he said it's evident today that Marxist ideology, as it has been conceived, no longer responds to reality. New models must be found though with patience. So, is the dream dead? The utopia dead? Particularly, as Marta said, for the young in Cuba.
Well, let me say something that is connected with what you just said. The fact that the Pope is in Cuba and he's telling this message, and the Bishop of Santiago de Cuba in the Mass yesterday talk about the end of foreign intervention, or he advocate for the end of foreign intervention in Cuban affairs, but he also advocate for national reconciliation and a dialogue between Cubans with different ideas. Or send a message to the world of a society in transition, a society that is in search of new paradigms. It's obvious that even former President Fidel Castro said that the Cuban model doesn't work even for us. That was quote unquote. So there is a debate there. There is a society in transition, and the world and Cuba both gain with the fact that this image of a society changing is going to the United States, to Canada, to the different parts of the world. I think that the dream, when you ask me about the dream, I need to separate two dreams, because Cubans of different ideas have dreamed together in the same bed, but they have different dreams. And beneath the Marxist-Leninist paradigm, there has been always a strong Cuban nationalism. And this Cuban nationalist utopia of building a country that need to be respected by the whole international community, and its sovereignty need to be respected by the United States, is a dream that has not died. The communist dream, I think, is on his way out. I'm not saying that all the dream of social justice is exhausted, because there is a great desire and a leftist culture in Cuba, but the idea of a Marxist-Leninist country, an atheist country, is gone. But the nationalist dream is well and alive.
So, Marta Hernandez-Alva, a bishop from Miami also spoke in San Diego, and apparently to great applause. There were also a number of Cuban Americans who'd come over from Miami. So how does that work on the ground in Cuba, the disconnect between the official rhetoric and again, when Raul Castro greeted the Pope, he talked about how the country remains determined to chart its own path and resist efforts by the most forceful power that history has ever known, referring to the United States. So How does this sort of love-hate thing work on the ground?
Okay. Well, you know, I think the rapprochement with the church is actually a minor political concession that the government has been making since the first visit of John Paul II in 1998. But there's a previous history to that because, you know, the Castros were raised by the Jesuits, you know. So actually, Fidel Castro has always had this strong humanist principles that, you know, were part of the doctrine of Jesuism. And so then in the 80s, he had all these relationships with the theology of liberation and with, you know, the theologians, poets of Nicaragua, Ernesto Cardenal. Then, you know, Fray Beto visited the island, and that went very well. So there's always been, you know, a connection between certain ideals of, you know, social justice that both the Christian Church and the revolution have had in common, you know. So I think that's still there for sure. Then you have to take into account also that when, you know, the visit of John Paul II, it went very well because actually the Pope criticized neoliberalism, you know, which I think, you know, the government could not expect that to happen. So, you know, if you have all this in mind and then, you know, you think about the fact that I think there's a strong Catholic population in Cuba, you know, and that, as I was saying before, it's a minor political concession. So why not, you know, to have this strategic alliance with the church, which, you know, is going to help them, for example, with the negotiations of the American embargo. It's going to help them with the international community, you know, insofar as, you know, they now look like a tolerant country, which, you know, has been modernized and westernized. And on the other hand, feed this, you know, this lack that the people have, this hope that the people have in that the regime can, like, you know, like Arturo was saying, can change paradigms, that there's a possibility of a change, you know?
Well, you referred to the Pope's denunciation, if you will, of capitalism, where he said there's a profound spiritual moral crisis which has left humanity devoid of values and defenseless before the ambition and selfishness of certain powers which take little account of the true good of individuals and families. Let me ask Arturo about what appears to be the official government line, and it comes up all the time. It's led people to think that the embargo has been one of the stupidest policies in political history, in the sense that the Castro brothers continually refer to it. He did again, when he met the Pope, referring to the overshadowing power next door. But on the other hand, you have increased tourism, and you have people coming in from Miami, as a number did for the Pope's visit. What's your sense on the ground of how Cubans navigate between the personal and the personal interchanges with Americans and the official political line against the American colossus?
Well, I'll go to Cuba generally once or twice a year. And when I go there, what I feel on the people is that there is a great opposition to the embargo, not only by the government, but also by anybody in the society, not only the church, the Protestant churches, the Jewish community, the Muslim community that it's also growing there. And this is a general feeling. At the same time, due to the recent speeches of Raul Castro and the debate that is happening in the island, many people are saying most of our economic problems are our own responsibility. The embargo is making things worse. The embargo is making more difficult to have an open debate about some of our problems, but the embargo is not the main reason of the difficult economic situation that Cuba has. This is very important because even Raúl Castro said that in a speech, that people should not use the embargo anymore as an alibi for everything. That said, it's clear that in the opposition against the embargo, there are coincidences between the church and the government, and I would say most of the Cuban population, and even now, 55% of the Cuban-American community. It's very interesting what you asked, Marta, about the Cuban-American community, because for the first time, or different from the visit in 1998, the Bishop of Miami has support the pilgrimage to the island, and even two Cuban-American bishops, one of them is the bishop from St. Augustine, has gone to Cuba as part of this trip. Obviously, the embargo is still a problem. The Cuban government will use every single opportunity to bring the issue to the press, because it's a very unpopular policy, not only in Cuba. It's very unpopular policy in the whole world. Some days ago, there was a discussion in Washington between Thomas Friedman, the columnist of the New York Times, and Celso Amorim, the former Brazilian Minister of Foreign Affairs, and the discussion was if the embargo was among the five stupidest, most stupid policies of the United States, or the embargo was among the 10 most stupid policies of the United States. The discussion was between the fifth or the 10 more stupid policies. So it's very unpopular, even in Washington.
Well, let me ask Marta about the influence or perhaps the waning influence of the Miami Cubans. A rising star in the Republican Party is Senator Marco Rubio. He's often touted as a possible vice presidential candidate. He's opposed the moderation of the Cuban Bishop Cardinal Ortega, and that seems to be completely, you know, in line with that kind of boneheaded tradition that Arturo just talked about in terms of the American lexicon of stupidity. What's your understanding of whether or not that kind of rhetoric is on the way out, and that kind of implication that the cardinal in Cuba, who's doing a lot of worthwhile work behind the scenes, is being castigated by the Miami Cubans for abandoning the moral imperatives and the moral strength of the church, etc.?
Well, you see, I in that sense, I think I disagree with what Arturo has said, because I don't see that this rhetoric of the evil of the empire has disappeared or is in any way disappearing. I would actually say it's the other way around, you know, because you had Raúl in the sixth Congress of the party last year say that again, you know, that the economic problems of the country have two sources. One of them is, you know, the embargo, and the other one is the corruption and the fact that people are corrupt when they didn't used to be corrupt. They don't have any work ethics anymore. Neoliberal ideas are entering the country, and so on and so forth. So, and again, you have, for example, this campaign of the five prisoners of the, you know, the five heroes, the five prisoners of the country, which, you know, the constant call to, and
Well, yes, I understand that. And there's also an American, Alan Gross, who's also a prisoner there as well.
Yes.
And there may be some sort of deal somewhere down the pike. I'm afraid, Arturo and Marta, we've run out of time here. I thank you both for joining us. I'm sorry if we don't have enough time, but we'll revisit this subject.
Okay. Well,
thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Arturo López-Levy, who is a former political analyst with the Cuban government. He's now a lecturer and PhD candidate at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He also teaches Latin American politics and comparative politics at the University of Denver and the Colorado School of Mines. And Marta Hernandez-Salvan is a professor of Hispanic Studies at the University of California in Riverside, whose current research focuses on the ideological and emotional trauma created after the withering of the socialist utopia in Cuba. Her forthcoming book, Hyperbolic Moment, studies the work of Cuban post-revolutionary poets and essayists. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about ALEC.
Revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about this, what have we done?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Brendan Fisher, a law fellow with the Center for Media and Democracy, who have recently made public a data dump from the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, detailing over 800 model bills that have been used for regressive legislation, such as the Stand Your Ground Law. You may find them at alecexposed.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brendan Fisher.
Thank you for having me.
And your group, the Center for Media and Democracy, have been at the forefront in exposing ALEC. And the more we learn about what happened down in Florida recently and the law that's involved in protecting the person who killed the young man, the more people, I think, are starting to wake up. There was a very good piece by Nobel economist Paul Krugman the other day in his New York Times column praising your center for bringing this information forth. I mean, it's difficult to know where to begin because ALEC is so ubiquitous. But I suppose you have to begin with the Koch brothers, right? They financed through Dick Armey and Karl Rove much of the Tea Party, and who swept into power in 2010. And particularly in state legislatures where they picked up the legislatures and the governorships. And that's when ALEC, who'd been around for a while, really hit the ground running, I take it.
Yeah. ALEC has actually been around since 1973. It was formed by Paul Weyrich, who also founded the Heritage Foundation the same year and went on to found the Free Congress. And, you know, people have been sounding the alarm about ALEC for about 10 or 15 years, but it's really only in this past year when we released over 800 of the previously secret model bills that you were really able to put the pieces together, that you were really able to identify just the extent and breadth of ALEC's influence on our politics. And like you said, there were a lot of state legislators who were ALEC members who were, you know, kind of on the back bench. And who didn't have the majorities in the state houses to really put the ALEC corporate agenda forward. And in 2010, they did. They swept the state houses, and all of a sudden you saw the introduction of almost identical legislation in a variety of states. You saw around 34 states introduce voter ID, which was modeled after the ALEC modeled off of the ALEC model voter ID bill. You saw the introduction of anti-union legislation in Wisconsin, in Indiana, in New Hampshire, in Ohio, most recently in Arizona. You saw the introduction of anti-environmental legislation, and so on. And that's we really started to see the extent of the ALEC influence. And then something that happened starting in 2005 was the introduction of the Stand Your Ground laws, and that's really pushed ALEC to the forefront in the past 2 weeks.
But I'm right, am I not, Brendan Fisher, in suggesting that the Koch brothers have played a pivotal role here. They're on the board of ALEC. They funded it through its lean times. As you say, it's been going since the 70s. But they also funded the Tea Party, and particularly Dick Armey and Karl Rove, who I think in many ways helped organize this sweep in 2010 in the legislatures. So there is a kind of thread here. Once they got the political power, these model bills were just languishing in the desks, right, ready to go. And out they came, and they've changed the country.
Mm-hmm. Sure. The Kochs have been involved in ALEC for at least the early 1990s. They gave a $500,000 loan to ALEC when it was having financial troubles, and they have sat on the ALEC Private Enterprise Board, the board that really helped elevate the corporate agenda. And there's a number of ALEC bills that really advance both the ideological and the business interests of Koch Industries and the Koch brothers. So there's the anti-union legislation. There's a number of different ALEC bills that would make it harder to sue corporations when they injure or kill. And, the Koch brothers have been involved in a variety of tort lawsuits when their pipelines have exploded. And they've been on the hook for millions of dollars. And one of the things that the ALEC model bills do is make it harder to hold corporations accountable when they injure or kill. The ALEC bills also promote an anti-environmental agenda, and Koch Industries is a major polluter, both with their oil industries and also with paper industries and paper production. They're a major polluter, and it's easier for them to do business, and it's easier for them to make more money if there's fewer environmental regulations, and ALEC is one way that they can really push that agenda.
It'd be useful, I think, Brendan Fisher, if you could just tell us exactly what ALEC does.
So ALEC, we like to call ALEC the corporate bill mill. What they do is they bring state legislators together with corporations and special interests like the National Rifle Association, and essentially they allow these corporations and special interests to hand the legislators changes to the state laws that they desire. Corporations and legislators have equal voting rights in ALEC. Corporations can propose a model bill, and for the most part, from what we've seen, is it usually just gets rubber stamped as and adopted as an ALEC model, which can then be distributed and passed in state houses across the country. So I think one really important thing to know about ALEC when you think about ALEC is they're not a traditional think tank. They're not like a Heritage Foundation or one of these types of right-wing groups. What they really are is a conduit for the corporate agenda. They give corporations unprecedented and unrivaled access to state legislators, both with the introduction of model bills, but then also ALEC legislators can attend ALEC conferences with their expenses paid for by the corporate members. They call them scholarships, but they reimburse legislators for their travel, for their hotel expenses, for their meals, and they've been able to narrowly evade a lot of state ethics and lobbying laws with what are essentially gifts by calling them a scholarship. So it's really layer of influence on top of layer of influence. And it's really amazing that it's lasted this long and people really just haven't paid much attention.
So what was their interest then, ALEC's interest and the backers of ALEC's interest in the Stand Your Ground law? Because that was pushed by the NRA, and I take it the NRA and ALEC worked together. But none of these, I think like 32, 34 states have adopted this Stand Your Ground law that's blown up in our faces in Florida. I mean, no state legislators, nobody, no citizens in Florida or any of these other states were beating the drum or picketing or demonstrating in favor of this law. It just suddenly came out of nowhere, freshly minted, and boom, it's in 32 states. Why? What was the point? So what's ALEC's agenda here?
Sure. Well, this is a pretty good case study in how ALEC works. And like I said, it's really, you know, it's really a conduit for corporations and ideological special interests to push their agenda. So in Florida, the NRA essentially drafted the bill. From the evidence we've seen, it appears that they at least conceived of the bill, possibly also drafted the bill, and through their lobbying and political influence, they were able to get legislators to introduce it, and it passed. And then months after it passed, the NRA brought the Florida bill to the American Legislative Exchange Council for and proposed it as a model bill. And it was unanimously approved, and then once it became an ALEC model bill, it was pushed out into the state legislatures. What we like to say is that once a bill becomes an ALEC model, then it becomes supercharged. Then you have more and more legislators knowing about it. You have the bill backed up by corporate dollars or by special interest dollars, by the incentive of campaign contributions, by the lobbying weight of the corporations or special interests that have an interest in the bill. But that's essentially what happened, that the NRA came up with the bill, they got it introduced in Florida, they brought it to ALEC, it became an ALEC model, and then it spread across the country.
But I understand why, for example, the anti-environmental laws are passed, pushed by the Koch brothers and others who have interest in oil and oil pipelines, etc., and who are constantly running afoul of environmental laws. I understand the logic of that. I understand the voter suppression laws that ALEC are pushing throughout all of the state legislatures in order to get Republicans elected, because they obviously more comfortable doing business with Republicans. That all makes sense. But why this stand your ground law? Who's making money out of that?
Well, I think I think there's a number of possible ways that people could make money, but it fits the agenda of the NRA, this extreme interpretation of the Second Amendment, and they really are trying to push this idea that everyone should be armed, and that your first resort should be to use a gun, that you should shoot first, and maybe ask questions later, maybe not ask questions later. And it seems like with the shooting of Trayvon Martin, it's really a shoot first, don't ask any questions at all. But there are also members of ALEC that do sell guns. Walmart is the largest seller of guns in the nation. They actually chaired the Criminal Justice Task Force that approved the NRA bill as a model. And you know, the NRA is closely associated with the gun industry, and they make more money when they sell more guns.
So, you mentioned Walmart selling a lot of guns. I understand that a lot of big American corporations back ALEC, the AT&T, Walmart, UPS. Can you name some of them?
Sure. If they're a large global corporation, there's a pretty good chance that they've been associated with ALEC. On the private enterprise board, in the past few years, the corporations that have been members have been Kraft Foods, you know, the maker of Kraft macaroni and cheese, Coca-Cola, Walmart, State Farm Insurance, Intel, the computer chip manufacturer, UPS, like you said, Diageo, which is a global consolidated liquor company that produces brands like Johnny Walker, Tanqueray, Smirnoff, Guinness, Verizon, a number of pharmaceutical companies, including Bayer and GlaxoSmithKline, as well as the pharmaceutical company Lobby Pharma. And Pharma also gave $350,000 in 2010 to ALEC Scholarship Fund that pays for legislators to travel to ALEC conferences. I think we've been initiating a campaign to ask these corporations to, you know, stop funding ALEC, to stop being a member of ALEC. Their response has generally been that for something like the Castle Doctrine law or the Stand Your Ground law in Florida, that maybe they weren't on the task force that actually voted to approve the law. But, you know, just by virtue of their membership, they're paying tens of thousands of dollars to be an ALEC member, and that funding is what makes these laws possible. It's what makes the spread of these laws possible. And without that funding, these laws would not be spreading across the country.
So I'm just trying to get to understand this, because I would have thought that, you know, you have thousands and up to millions of people now starting to demonstrate pretty much on a daily basis around the country against the Stand Your Ground law. And if they were to know that these big corporations like Coca-Cola, that presumably most of them drink Coca-Cola, were funding the very people who are propagating and proliferating these laws, these regressive laws, then maybe they would join a consumer boycott. So how, if you were, you said you've approached, your organization has approached Coca-Cola and UPS and these big corporations about their association, and they say they weren't on the task force. Is that their excuse?
That tends to be their excuse. Coke Industries has just released a letter today, basically saying that you know, we weren't on the task force that approved this bill, so therefore we bear no responsibility. But that's just misleading, because they were, for one thing, they were on the board that provides some guidance to the ALEC, to the overall ALEC organization, but also more importantly than anything else, they were funding the group. And that their funding makes it possible for these laws to become a model and for them to spread across the country.
So, again, I'm speaking with Brendan Fisher, who's a law fellow with the Center for Media and Democracy, who have recently made public a data dump from the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, detailing over 800 model bills that have been used for regressive legislation, such as the Stand Your Ground law. You may find them at alecexpose.org. So what about the idea of a consumer boycott? I've often wondered why liberals and progressives who are appalled at the malignant influence of the Koch brothers in our politics, and clearly with the evidence from Citizens United, you could make a case that we are becoming less and less of a democracy and more of an oligarchy every day, given that a few handful of billionaires are deciding our political fate in this election. What about the idea that people who don't like the Cokes don't have to buy Dixie cups, Georgia-Pacific products, Brawny paper towels, and a number of other products? Now, could that be extended to these other corporations that fund ALEC? Because they've got what they've wanted using ALEC through these legislatures. They've got their payoff, often at the expense of the American consumer and the American citizen. Is there any evidence that the American citizen is going to strike back?
Sure. Well, I think that's something that's possible in the future. I think at the moment we're trying to elevate and make people aware of some of these associations with ALEC, some of these corporations' association with ALEC. State Farm Insurance goes out of its way to try and foster a friendly image, to say that, you know, they're a good neighbor. Coca-Cola tends to inspire nostalgia when you think of it. You don't tend to think of racial profiling. You don't tend to think of discriminatory voter ID laws. You don't tend to think of deregulatory environmental laws. So I think building up these associations is one important step, because a lot of times what ALEC is doing is contrary to the brand image. A boycott could be a next step. It's not something that we're calling for at the moment. The group Color of Change, they're the African American online community organization that successfully led the boycott against Glenn Beck's advertisers. They've initiated a campaign where they're, you know, working behind the scenes with these corporations and asking them to disassociate themselves from ALEC, essentially saying that you can't come to our community 364 days of the year and ask for our money and then turn around on the 365th day and take away our vote through voter ID laws and other voter restrictions. So I think they're working behind the scenes, and then if the corporations refuse to comply, if they refuse to work with them, you know, then a boycott could be the next step. But I think one piece of this is just really letting these corporations know that you're not happy about their association with ALEC. You're not happy about your consumer dollars essentially being used to fund some of these nefarious agenda items.
Well, just in closing, Brendan Fisher, there seems to have been a clever strategy here and somewhat under the radar of targeting state legislatures. And they've been around for a long time, as you mentioned, ALEC.
And they've recently met with huge success since they've helped, the same people who fund ALEC also funded the Tea Party and the election of a lot of these conservatives who've taken over state legislatures and state governorships. Is there any evidence that there's any similar strategic thinking on the progressive side in this country, or progressives continually reacting and quite often after the not you know the barn doors open and the horse is way down the paddock?
I think there's been some talk about trying to find a more progressive alternative to ALEC. I haven't seen anything just yet. One part of it is just that part of the reason that ALEC has been able to be so successful is because there's so many corporations that have so much money that are interested in making it successful. And, you know, money rules a lot of things. And, I think that's going to be a little bit more difficult for progressives just because of the money issue.
Well, I remember some time back speaking with Lisa Graves, who runs your organization, the Center for Media and Democracy, and she was down in New Orleans covering an ALEC meeting. And you say that these corporations, these big blue-chip corporations like ExxonMobil, AT&T, and Coca-Cola and UPS, give scholarship money to the legislatures. But what she was describing were people living pretty high off the hog. These legislators were down staying in expensive hotels with expensive meals, and you know, I'm sure they had their prayer breakfasts paid for or their prostitutes paid for, depending upon their predilections.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's level of influence on top of level of influence, and it's funding legislators' trips to ALEC conferences. It's handing them model legislation that benefits their interests, and then after hours, it's corporate lobbyists taking out the legislators for drinks, maybe for more, paying for it all, and legislators have a great time, and they come home, they feel affectionate towards the corporations that paid their way, and then they introduce the ALEC model bill that tends to benefit that corporation's bottom line, and you know it's a tough nut to crack.
Well, Brendan Fisher, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Brendan Fisher, a law fellow with the Center for Media and Democracy, who have recently made public a data dump from the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, detailing over 800 model bills that have been used for regressive legislation such as the Stand Your Ground law. You may find them at alecexposedoneword.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.